You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
Hey guys, you're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We interview the very best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and even entrepreneurial worlds. And with their help, we give you some of the best advice on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review.
On today's episode, episode number 213, entitled, How to Actually Fight, Keep Yourself Safe, and Protect Your Loved Ones from Real-World Assaults and Violence, I chat with David Kahn. David Kahn is a United States Chief Instructor and authority to Israeli Krav Maga self-defense training. In today's episode, David talks about keeping yourself and your loved ones safe no matter what threat or danger comes your way. He covers the real-world tools needed to de-escalate a potentially dangerous situation, but also physically fight if you have to. David shares his vast experience training some of the most elite combatants in the world in self-defense and how the average Joe can use his incredible techniques to keep safe too. If you're wondering how to actually fight in a real-life street conflict and keep your loved ones safe in a potentially deadly altercation, check this episode out now. You are going to love it. If you haven't joined our Elite Man newsletter yet, you are missing out. Get on it right now. Go to elitemanmagazine.com/newsletter and sign up to get special Elite Man content not seen nor heard anywhere else. Get all of our bonus podcast information, sneak peeks, and upcoming shows, behind-the-scenes content, special offers, and exclusive Elite Man updates you won't find anywhere else. I'm telling you, if you're not on our newsletter, you are missing out. Go to elitemanmagazine.com/newsletter and become a true member of the Elite Man community. I look forward to speaking to you soon. elitemanmagazine.com/newsletter. Letter. All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from EliteManMagazine.com, and my guest today is David Kahn from DavidKahnKravMaga.com. David, thanks so much for coming on the show, man.
Hey, Justin, thanks so much. Just want to give a shout out to you. Your website's fantastic. I really enjoyed prepping for the podcast and reading all the great material you have on there.
Hey, thanks, man. I appreciate that. It means a lot. And yeah, I'm a big fan of your work as well. As I mentioned a couple moments ago, I know you're doing some incredible. I know you have done. I mean, your record in the past in this field, martial arts, has been incredible. Just doing some little bit of research that I did on you. And then I know you're doing some really impressive stuff with actually some of the best NFL players in the world, like Khalil Mack and the tight end, the defensive end from, I think, the Rams. Donald or something. I should know this too because they just played the Patriots in the Super Bowl. I'm from Boston. I forget his name now, but yeah. I know you're doing some incredible work, needless to say, with those guys and really just kind of, you know, changing the way people view Krav Maga and martial arts.
I appreciate that very much. And we're, you know, I'm just so lucky to work with the top Israeli instructors. The credit goes to them. And we made some real inroads. And working with these professional athletes, the defensive tackle for the Rams, Aaron Donald, who just got the defensive player of the year yet again. So he was the 2017 and 2018 player, along with Khalil Mack, who was the 2016 NFL defensive player of the year. These guys are the best at what they do in their positions. They're just incredible athletes, and they're equally good guys. They're really good human beings, citizens, and they give a great deal back to the communities.
Yeah. How is it working with some of these guys? Like, these guys are the most elite of elite athletes in the world. Like, you're talking like 6'6" and running like 4'5", 4'6", 40 times, like, you know, jumping 4 feet up in the air. I mean, they can do incredible things that like 99.9% of the population can't do. How has been working with them in the last couple of years? Like, how is it different working with these types of guys?
They're exceptional athletes. We are not going to win on strength, speed, or power. Let alone size with them. So the tactics have got to be, they've got to be expeditious, and they got to be effective. Again, you're not going to win in an athletic contest of strength with them. And so therefore it actually proves out how the tactics can work against a bigger, larger, skilled, and perhaps athletically superior opponent. That is to say, they pick up these tactics very quickly, too, because, as I mentioned, they're just some of the best athletes ever. And the deal is they are able to adapt and adopt the tactics for their respective positions. And we're talking about just maybe a dozen tactics altogether. And it really refines what they do, which is similar to some of the other professional circles we work in, you know, with the military and law enforcement. We're not there to reinvent the wheel. Good minds think alike. And there are going to be more similarities than dissimilarities. So we try to hone what they've already got. I always like to add, you know, adding a few arrows to their already well-stocked quivers.
Mm, yeah. And so when you actually, so what is it you're actually doing with these guys? What is it that they're getting out of training with you and learning some of these Krav Maga moves? And I mean, they're already like genetic beasts, like freaks of nature. What do they need Krav Maga for?
The great credit goes to my training partner. I want to shout out to him, Albert Pudi Carson, who's a full-time police officer. Mm-hmm. Pudi was really instrumental in getting us in the NFL circles. I had met him when training with a bunch of state police agencies in Pennsylvania, and he was a football coach and had played as a free agent. So he played offensive line. I played defensive back. Most of the tactics are can be adapted for all positions, but particularly in the trenches with the offensive lineman and the defensive lineman jockeying for position. So the idea, again, is we work on a few hand movements, and the idea is to keep going. We're not there to fight in place or to exchange blows, such as you might see in a Muay Thai match or another kind of MMA match. They've got the assignment, they've got to take care of it, and they've got to move past that blocker or, you know, whoever's trying to interfere with he who's legally blocking them and get to the assignment. So we've got to be able to shed the block. That also includes some multiple opponent strategies, such as Krav Maga does with double teams and similar to football. We don't want to get in the middle of two people, but again, that's a sport. So it's a tough sport, but it's a sport. Whereas on the street, I'll never get in between two people if I can help it. Sometimes in football, they've got to get that assignment and that gap, and they've got to take on a double team. So there's a difference right there. Another difference, of course, is that Krav Maga is designed to inflict damage. It's designed to take somebody down with efficiency and brutality. For football, we don't want to injure anybody, so it's more adapted for the sporting element of it. And sometimes people ask, well, are there any Krav Maga competitions? Because it can be so... or it's designed to debilitate and to create damage. The short answer is in the last few years, the Israel Defense Forces has actually implemented some training competitions, but there are some select rules, such as not kicking to the knee, not hitting to the throat, not hitting the base of the skull, no joint manipulation, small joint manipulations, that is. So there are rules to protect the combatants, let's say, so that they can go on and their soldierly duties. Maybe one of the best ways to explain it, the actual Krav Maga, for everything that is banned in the UFC and other mixed martial arts competitions for fighter safety, are exactly the tactics that Krav Maga emphasizes. So again, we're talking about taking somebody's knee out, kicking to the groin, fish hooking, eye gouges, chops to the carotid, elbows to the back of the skull or base of the neck, targeting the liver, the kidneys, the floating ribs, other pressure points too. So again, In the interest of sporting, obviously, not get anybody injured, you've got to ban or skew these kinds of techniques.
Wow! So it sounds like Krav Maga is pretty pretty ruthless, pretty vicious. Needless to say, so what? So those are the. I think I might have misheard you wrong too. I think you said something like they don't allow some of those things. Is it in competition they don't allow some of those moves, but in like regular self defense, that's kind of what they emphasize. Is that right?
Correct. You know, again, they're wearing the IDF in that case. They're wearing protective equipment when they're fighting. Grandmaster Gidon, who I've been fortunate to train under for over two decades now, we've got a different way of doing it. And one of the things we do is called Mishat Krav, which is play fighting. But what it means at a high level is that I'm able to deliver a sidekick to somebody's knee, and it's signaling to them that I just basically blew their knee out. Or I'm able to use the rule of thumb by putting my hand on their cheekbone and gently touching their eye or their eyebrow to show that I'm delivering an eye gouge where I could spoon out the eye if I had to. So we can practice these things, but under strict control. And that's why the training is so important and having a good training partner who is going to resist and not give up and fight you for all that he or she is worth, but also not injure you. It's a key balancing act.
Yeah, so it sounds to me like Krav Maga is actually the like perfect martial art to learn for self-defense in like real life application. Like, you're not going to have rules, you're not going to say, you know, no kicks to the knees, no eye gouging. Like, someone's attacking you and you're, you know, life or death type of thing, they're going to do whatever they're going to do to try to take you down, maybe even kill you, and to know the types of defenses and also the types of attacks to save yourself and, you know, your loved ones, I think is probably the best approach to have.
I believe so. And Krav Maga is certainly not the only self-defense discipline, or if you want to call it a martial art. I tend to stay away from the term martial art because it is such a street-oriented type of system. And not that any other martial arts are no good. They're all terrific. It's just that this has got to be practical, and we don't really emphasize high kicks to the head and other things that that take a great deal of training and skill to do. But that's also important to say that it can make you an elite fighter in a short time, because we'll get counter arguments that, you know, from different martial arts, we'll protect our eyes, we're not going to give you our knees, we're not going to do this. We're not necessarily targeting the vulnerable anatomy right away, because we understand people will cover up, but we'll get there, and we'll get there in short order. So when anybody launches an attack, unless they're able to get that first shot in at you, it could be a knife, it could be a bullet for that matter, or an impact to the head, they are vulnerable. Because by the very nature of extending and putting one's arms up or leaning forward to punch or grab or choke, there are always going to be vulnerabilities, because they're committing part of their body, exposing another part of the body. And that's why Krav Maga for civilians is more on the defensive side. The military is about attacking, and that's another discussion altogether. But ultimately, the principle is the same. It's really about preemptive self-defense. If there's no choice to avoid the situation, to de-escalate the situation, and to escape it, then the literally if push comes to shove, we turn the tables on the attacker, and the mindset is attack the attacker, either preemptively as the attacker launches the attack or makes an aggressive movement. Bunch of kinesic indicators can indicate by leaning forward, bulging the eyes, narrowing the eyes, bulging at the neck, clenching the fist, disrobing, a whole bunch of them, moving on the balls of the feet. But all those can be indicators that aggression is forthcoming, and then it can also be articulated when you have to answer legally for what you did, why you did, and how you did it. So all that is important to keep in mind when assessing a threat. And again, for listeners, it's the hands and it's the intent. And oftentimes, if the hand gestures don't mesh with the verbal explanations, focus on the physical manifestations, the hand gestures or the eyes or anything, the totality of the circumstances in physical movements will override whatever that person is saying. So that's the focus if we can give that advice.
Yeah. I want to dive back. I want to dive in a minute into how you actually got hooked up with Krav Maga and, you know, went down this incredible journey that you've been on, I think for the last few decades, if I'm not mistaken. But real quick, that I just had a question pop up in my mind was, where does wrestling come into play? Like, if you're in a, say, a type of street fight or something, because I know you mentioned a lot of like strikes and different types of moves to take somebody out quickly. But say, you know, there's a wrestling kind of scenario and someone just like goes to tackle you. Is there ground defense? Is there wrestling moves? Is there like jujitsu type of things that you have in Krav Maga as well?
All of it. Okay. Amy, the founder of Krav Maga, was a European wrestling champion. Current Grandmaster Chaim Gidon has a great wrestling background. So there's certain backgrounds which actually fit really well with Krav Maga. Boxing is one. Wrestling is one. Judo, jujitsu. Most every martial art has something to offer, for sure, and they're all good in their own right. And so when you discuss Krav Maga, wrestling is a big part of it. The difference, of course, now is that there are no rules, and it sets up a great athletic base and an understanding of movement, body shift, weight distribution that is readily applied to a no-rules type of fight.
Okay, cool. No, that makes a lot of sense, and you know, clears up a lot of things that I kind of had floating around, like question-wise, of like how it all fits together. But David, I'm really curious, how did you, so it sounds like this is, well, you know, I know from what you just said, it's an Israeli defense forces, that's what they teach, that's what they train them, is Krav Maga. How did you get hooked up with this? And you know, it sounds like, are you an American, by the way, like born in America?
I am. Yep. I was born in New Jersey. I went to college here at Princeton, and then eventually I went to law school, which is where I was so lucky to stumble on one of the best Krav Maga instructors in the world. My first instructor, Rick Blitzstein. I literally was just walking around campus, and I happened to run into him reading underneath a shelter. It was hot, so it was Florida, so he was under the shade, reading a newspaper, and he's wearing a shirt that said Krav Maga, Israeli martial arts. And I said, well, what is that? And he said, oh, it's called Krav Maga, which means contact combat. He said, you look like you'd be interested. I said, yeah. But I've repeated the story. I was a pretty serious student, and I said, I've got to really focus on law school. That was the first week. By the second week, I was seeking Rick, and I was so disenchanted with what I was going to do in law school. I needed an outlet. So Rick helped me get through 3 years of private training and on to Grandmaster Yidan in Israel, which was where I began more extensive training.
Wow, that's pretty cool. So how many years ago was that?
That is coming up on, let's see, we're about 24 years now.
Wow. So you just basically fell in love with it. Did you even go into the law thing after you graduated, or was it just strictly into this?
I actually had the opportunity after graduation to go to Israel for a nearly six-week course, training all hours of the day with Grandmaster Gidon. Chaim was so generous with his time and his investment in training. You know, I'll never forget it. And I'm always, anything I write, anything I do, I feel honored to dedicate it to Chaim and my other instructors, Rick, everybody. So I went to Israel, and then that summer, right after I graduated from law school, and then I went to work in New York, and I used my legal training as an underwriter for e-business with a big insurance group, and I started teaching in New York shortly after that. So I used my legal degree. I write some patents for my own development and do some financial structuring as well, along with my passion for teaching and writing about Krav Maga, along with filming certain aspects of it as well.
Yeah, and I know we talked about this too before we went on, that you've actually trained someone that's been a past guest on the show, Gershon Ben-Karen, who was a couple of years back, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, was a guest on the show. Really good guy. You actually had a chance to train him. How did that go?
Well, the first time Gershon and I met was in London, when I was brought over to do a couple of seminars. And he's a really good guy. I like his writing. I think he's got some great insights on criminology. And I then invited him and four other people to Israel to train with Grandmaster Yehuda, and they came for a three-day course. And he had other Krav Maga training, so I think he was able to distinguish why the Gidon Krav Maga and that which I've been taught and then tried to pass on to him is different. So I was up at his school in Boston. He's got a different background, so he'll put other tactics in. But as I said, what he emulates that we do, I applaud.
No, that's pretty cool. It's definitely... it's a neat little connection there, too. It's like, you've trained this guy in the past. He was a former guest on the show. He actually spoke at the conference that we had a few years ago and talked about this type of stuff. So hey, I'm very intrigued by this whole... I've always been intrigued by self-defense and martial arts. And I did boxing for a few years, did wrestling for a few years, did jiu-jitsu for a couple of years. But I never actually did something like this, like the more practical, as you call it, like self-defense system. I've done different martial arts, but I never did something. It's probably something I want to do in the future, but maybe I'll look you up in a couple of years or like a year or so. We can get together and try something, but it's awesome. Man, I'm very fascinated.
Listen, you're gonna get a bunch of books sent to you, personally signed, of course. I'm gonna get you the full Mastering Krav Maga DVD series, which is about there are four series and I guess about 30 discs. And we'll get you on light training. So you're going to get walloped by Krav Maga, literally and figuratively. Look for it.
I love it, man. Thank you. I appreciate that. And so you're talking about, are people able to, like, if I get the DVDs and I watch them all, which I will, because I'm that kind of person that'll just like run right through them for whatever, as long as it takes. Am I actually going to be able to learn and pick up some of these tactics, these trainings, these teachings that you have, like just by watching the DVDs, or is it something like a martial art that you have to, do for years at a time, or even like say months on end, just to actually really start to learn some of the moves?
You really can learn if you've got a good training partner, and that's the key. Mm-hmm. Whether it's in class or whether it's online, the Mastering Krav Maga online is designed. And the caveat is that you can do many of the combatives, which are the strikes and everything that our book number 6 is based on a heavy bag or in a mirror. But it's best to have a partner either behind the heavy bag or the ability to hold a kick and shield or something like that you can move and can move towards you to simulate an attack. The key, again, is you've got to work with each other in a cooperative fashion in the beginning, but then you've got to amp it up. And it's really, your progress is going to depend on how your training partner progresses as well. So it's a win-win in that sense. Obviously, it's always better to get instructor or in-person instructor training. Our development cycle is pretty extensive. It takes us a while to develop instructors. Usually for a full instructor, It's about 2 years of training in our schools, and then we'll put them through some instructor training. Grandmaster Gidon, when we used to do the courses in Israel, or we do them, it was usually a green belt level, which was about 3 years, and then they would go through instructor training. But the key with any instruction is there's so many good people out there teaching, you know, all sorts of martial arts, Krav Maga, everything. The ability to teach is an asset and a skill set in itself. But if you don't know the material or it's not good material, that can lead you down the wrong path. So hopefully the National Krav Maga Online, the DVDs, the books, will show what Krav Maga, at least in our opinion, is, and equally important, what it is not. So you can evaluate, for example, if somebody want to try Krav Maga, I always want people to try, you know, go to a local school, see if it's a good fit for you. The good schools out there should not require a long-term commitment. If they have faith in what they do and what they teach, people should want to come back and not be obligated to come back. That's kind of my thinking on it. And anybody who wants to start the training should also be able to take a few classes for free. But the big thing, again, is it's not designed as a physical a PT class for training and everything else. You get a great workout in, but you should actually be doing self-defense techniques that are realistic and Krav Maga based with a great workout added to it, not jumping jacks and push-ups and anything else, because unfortunately, much of the Krav Maga world has commercialized it. And out of a 60-minute class, you may get 40 minutes of cardio, which is very, very good, yeah. And 20 minutes of tactic. But what I'm driving at here is that it's becoming known as an exercise fad. And there are a bunch of like-minded instructors out there who've done many, many years training and you know, have been initiated by some of the best, who are we're frustrated by this because it's really ruining the reputation.
Yeah, it's good to, like, you know, sell a lot of DVDs, you know, and get the mainstream media to hop on board. And, you know, a lot of mothers trying to take an exercise class after work. But, you know, for realistic, practical purposes, I don't think you're really quite getting what you want to. So when you have a training partner, are you actually going, like, back and forth, like sparring and you know, sort of doing some strikes on each other? Or is it just like all technique working and stuff?
No, the different ways of doing it. There's are what we call closed techniques and open techniques. A closed technique is what you referred to in the former statement, where you know that something is going to be done and you're just getting the basic movements down. An open technique is where some kind of attack is coming at you. Maybe none at all. It depends on your reaction. In other words, sometimes we'll feint an attack and won't do anything. So, you know, again, it's building up a reaction cycle or a instinctive reactive response where you're not thinking. The important thing also with the training is that one approach that I've got is with all the filming that we do, I always try to show what is proper form and then what are the common mistakes. And we're able to recognize and diagnose these common mistakes from years of teaching and really understanding how the body moves naturally and when people get a little bit lazy, what they do. Again, it's not a criticism of anybody. It just takes time and practice. So one of the things that I'm keen on showing, again, with the Master and Krav Maga Online and all the DVDs is the correct way to do it, and then what you might do as a beginner in a mistake, just a common mistake you want to do, and you want to look out for it. Because, again, we want to make people as good as they can be, and we also want to create economy of training and time, that we don't want you to waste any time making mistakes, where if I can explain what not to do, it can obviate you were making a mistake, and therefore your training cycle, your training ability is enhanced.
When people go through your course, your training, your DVDs, or when they actually work with you in person for X amount of time, and they go through the actual, like, trainings that you're offering them, what's the end goal for them? What is the takeaway that you want to make sure that they have when they're done with your training? Like, what is their ability when they're walking around on the street? Like, how safe are they? What types of abilities to defend themselves are they going to have?
Yes, the goal, once we get our hands on somebody, forgive the pun, a good student that is to make he or she capable of defending any number of unarmed street attacks, which are the typical types of social violence, and they're different, four different kinds of violence. I can get into that if you'd be interested. But really what we're talking about is avoidable conflict, that sort of thing, pushing, punching, grabbing. And within 3 months of concerted training, we can get the average person pretty much tuned up to defend against the most common attacks, which was my book number 5. Called Krav Maga Defense. And those are usually pushes, overhand hooks, sort of haymakers, straight punches, sucker punches, grabs, takedowns, chokes, and a little bit of key ground survival. So again, it's to give you a few tactics, get them ingrained in the shortest amount of time, get you up to speed and make everything instinctive, and really inculcate anatomical targeting if you have to do it. But of course, before all that, we're also emphasizing the avoidance, recognizing danger before it actually becomes a danger, avoiding conflict, avoiding violence, that sort of thing. And it's worked for me in the past. I'm more successful with talking my way out of stuff than I am engaging. And in the U.S. in particular, such a litigious place these days, if you act in self-defense, you are going to have to pay one way or another. You're going to have to get an attorney. It's called an affirmative defense, where you are owning up to what you did. You're admitting to having done what you've done, and all likelihood it's going to be filmed with the number of cameras and mobile devices out there. And it is a legal justification before the law that you were able to defend yourself and you had the right to do so. So really, avoidance is the only fight you're sure to win and to get out of unscathed.
Yeah, I want to talk about the more sexier topic of the some of the strikes and some of the defending yourself against haymakers and sucker punches and some of those physical moves. But like you just mentioned a moment ago, let's talk for a moment about the de-escalation process. Like the most important really factor of it all is just avoiding it. Like at all costs, because like you said, especially in the U.S. and I'm sure a lot of other countries, but definitely in the U.S., like no matter what you do, even if you're 100% right, if you get into some kind of physical conflict with somebody, you're going to get in trouble. You're going to have a lot of crap to deal with, a lot of time in court, a lot of payments to lawyers and things like that you don't want to even have to deal with. So what is the first step to de-escalating and what's the biggest takeaway for that?
Common sense more than anything else. it's really one of the keys, and you've got to handle anger management in such a way that it's not an attack on one's masculinity. It's something you can walk away from, and you haven't been physically jolted or battered. There's no point in getting into it with somebody. Again, I avoided at all costs. When I was working in New York on the subways, it was extremely crowded. Everybody tries to maintain their personal space. Sometimes you just can't. For example, when walking along, you'll get people who want to take up the sidewalk. They're usually larger people or bully types. Maybe they're oblivious, but rather than running into somebody, I'll just sidestep them. It's just got to be that kind of common courtesy. Mm-hmm. The thing is, if avoidance and de-escalation escape fail, and I'm going to get back to some of the avoidance issues, the goal, you can't waver about resorting to counter-violence in the face of violence. And I call it counter-violence because you're not orchestrating it or initiating it, you're responding, you're reacting. It's got to be done really quickly because in a situation where confrontation comes, the aggressor has the benefit of action and you have to react. So acting will always be faster than reacting because you're reacting with stimulus. He's initiating and you've got to then counter it. So again, there's no pity or humanity or anything like that when the counterforce is legally justifiable. But you've got to be able to articulate what you did and why you did it. And the key language is that you've got to be objectively reasonable to allow for your affirmative defense, I mentioned. And today, rules govern the proportionality of permissible counterforce. Self-defense is defined as reasonably using counterforce to protect yourself from suffering potential injury. And you're going to have to explain it as such. So I'm just going to pull up something here for you. To justify your actions, you're going to have to explain, and this is all in the Krav Maga Combatives book, that you recognize the difference between normal movements versus attack movements in a police statement and possibly on the witness stand. Your pre-existing learned knowledge of threats, in other words, you'll likely need to explain your observations when another person presents countermeasures. In other words, you're trying to walk away and he or she is still closing the distance on you, or you're trying to see what he or she may have hidden behind the back, and you're trying to cut the angle, and then they keep turning, shielding what's in the hand. In a preemptive self-defense situation where you attack the attacker before the attacker can attack you, you've got to explain why the attack that you perceived from this person was not just possible, but was likely or highly probable. In other words, when a person acts in a manner consistent with attack movements. And finally, there was no reasonable preclusion or you could not retreat. There was nowhere for you to go. You had to act with, objectively reasonable counterforce, also accounting for the fear and adrenaline, which can also, explain inconsistencies in your statement or a video when you're being interviewed post-event. So, you've got to be able to explain, if the prosecutor or the police officer says, why was it necessary to kick and severely damage the other party's knee? Why did you attack the other party's eyeball? You know, after you knee the other party in the head, why did you stomp on the other his ankle? After disarming the other party and creating distance, why did you shoot him? And finally, that you didn't create the violent confrontation. So these are all things that were explained. For example, if I were being choked from the front and the person were able to get his hands around my windpipe, if I put my thumb into his eye and severely damage his cornea, it's a life and death situation because I don't know how long he's going to hold that choke. He might want to render me unconscious. He might want to hold on and kill me. Same thing if I get a trained fighter or a much bigger person or multiple opponents and I kick the opponent's knee, you know, damaging, maybe destroying the MCL and the ACL altogether so that he can't come after me. In other words, I'm putting him down, I'm crippling him momentarily, hopefully he'll heal, but so that he can't get up and continue to attack, especially if it's a woman against a larger male or you're dealing with three or four opponents. And that's one of the focuses, if I might say, for the last or the sixth book that we're putting out, that Emi, the founder, knew that he was always outnumbered in Slovakia when Krav Maga was first developed. It wasn't called that quite yet, but he was always outnumbered. And there was never time to deliver two or three subpar combatants. In other words, a feckless punch or a kick or something, because if he didn't take care of that first attacker with all that he could, and this goes down history with all the top instructors. Chaim has done this, unfortunately, on the street in Turkey and elsewhere. If you don't take the first aggressor out, the second aggressor is going to be on you right away. And then so that's when you get overwhelmed. So everything's got to count. And that's the kind of the purpose of the book number six, that it does matter how you deliver combatives. It does matter. We want you to use the best and optimal movement you can using economy of motion. And if necessary, the most debilitating strike you can deliver in the shortest amount of time. We got the number one goal is to keep you safe, the defender, and then we'll explain what we do.
Real quickly, that knee strike, is that outlawed in mixed martial arts like the UFC, like just taking somebody's knee out like that?
Well, I can say this definitively. UFC 1, I do not think it was when there were no rules. I think there was only fish hooking, but I could be wrong. Some aficionados might correct me. But the current competitions do ban it, and for good reason. It's just a debilitating kick. And to keep in mind, I'm working on book number 7, which will be defeating skilled ambushers and attackers. What we can do, somebody else can do. So all of our counter tactics have in mind the very tactics that we can use. And that goes to the military in a specific capacity as well. In other words, I know how to choke somebody pretty well, and I know what the opponent can do to me, and therefore I've got to counter the counter, if that makes sense.
Most subscription boxes are full of samples and junk you'll never use, but not BattleBox. It's the monthly subscription box for men full of solid gear for adventure seekers, survivalists, and outdoor enthusiasts. BattleBox is your monthly subscription for hand-picked outdoor survival and everyday carry gear. BattleBox introduces you to the best products, new gear, and innovative companies at a much lower cost than if you were to buy them individually. Plus, who doesn't like to get a package full of mystery adventure gear? I know I do. I recently got my own BattleBox and absolutely loved it. I felt like a kid on Christmas morning. I'm telling you, this thing was so cool. It had incredible knives, saws, flashlights, lamps, survival food, tourniquets, wound healing stuff, walkie-talkies, outdoor bags, everything you could want if you go out in the wilderness or go out camping or hiking or any one of those things. It's just an incredible box full of so many cool things. So do me a favor and go to trybattlebox.com/eliteman and pick the box that you want. They start at just $25 per month. Plus, they release a video for each new box so you can see what's coming and how to use it. They've shipped over 500,000 boxes and they won Best Men's Subscription Box for 2017. Sign up today and be ready for anything. Right now, our listeners get a free tactical knife when you sign up for your first BattleBox at trybattlebox.com/eliteman. That's trybattlebox.com/eliteman. Right now, get your first BattleBox plus a free tactical knife at trybattlebox.com/eliteman.
So what do you do if you do, say, face someone who's way bigger than you, like one of these NFL type of dudes who's just massive, or you face someone who's like a professional mixed martial artist and, you know, they're a jackass and they pick a fight with you? What is like the best, what is the best action at that point?
Well, you know, again, to de-escalate, and the problem, again, with some of the NFL guys, maybe some of the linemen, but they're in pretty good shape, too. You can outrun them. I'll give you an example. I was training a very, very strong NFL guy in Florida, and a really good guy, but he wanted to test me a little bit. And he was 6'3", and ran a sub 4'4", 40, and about 250 pounds. Wow. A really good guy. So he was giving, he's interested in MMA. So he started throwing some jabs at me, and I'm only about 5'11". So he outreached me. I switched my stance and I gently caught him in the knee with a heel. And he was horrified because he said, "Mike, you know, you can damage me this way, my career." I said, "No, if I wanted to damage you, I would have." I was signaling to him that, you know, I wasn't fooling around.
Yeah.
And I said to him, you know, again, I've got very good control. It takes years to develop. And so that same good guy, because we were friends, he came after me and tried to tackle me. And again, he's bigger. And I went to what we call a Z guard, because I won't go in the guard because it's a, you know, it's a great application for many things, but not necessarily the street, because you can get punched in the groin or elbowed or grabbed. And therefore, we do it, so we know not to do it. So I use a Z-guard, which is a four-leg brace, top and bottom, and I put my thumb in his eye. And he started screaming, "Get your thumb out of my eye! Get your thumb out of my eye!" I said, "Fine." I took the thumb out of my his left eye, and then I fish-hooked his right eye with my middle finger. He didn't like that either. So he said, "Boy, you guys fight dirty." But the whole lesson there is that you cannot lose. It doesn't matter who you're fighting. You're going to take the fight to that person. It's superior mindset. And of course, when you get two great fighters, some of the top guys in Israel, when they fight each other, it's really just a fraction of a second about who gets that first shot and then uses retzef, which is the concept developed by Grandmaster Chaim Gidon of continuous motion. There's a lot of talk about retzef. It's Chaim Gidon who developed it. And the best way I can explain it is you've got to understand the combatives, which is, again, the purpose of Book 6, to be able to implement retzef, because one combative follows another seamlessly and effortlessly, so to speak. You're using weight shifts and balancing that logically set up the next attack, coupled with what you see as vulnerable anatomy. So there are a bunch of combinations out there that can be used. The difference is it's not a series. It's not a 1, 2, 3, 4, and then retreat. It's like a sniper shot. You get that first shot in, and then you go fully automatic with your counterattack. And lastly, I took somebody to task because he just, another Krav Maga book came out using the word retzef. And he claims to be the first one to put it in print. But I mentioned in 2004 more than 90 times in my first book, Krav Maga Central Defense. So everybody should learn it. But I just want to give attribution to Grandmaster Chaim Gidon. He is the originator and, you know, in my opinion, the best Krav Maga instructor in the world. His sons are next.
Yeah, wow. That's pretty cool, man. So I think a lot of people, too, they have like a false sense of security when they do some of the... I know I did, actually, you know, when I first started boxing and did some wrestling, like a false sense of belief that, you know, I'm pretty badass. I can take most guys out there and, you know, no one's gonna fuck with me kind of thing, right? So, but what you're saying is even huge, giant, you know, NFL players, these guys that are massive and super athletic... Even those guys, or even professional mixed martial artists in some cases, you know, if they don't know how to actually have they don't know what to do in a real street fight when like life or death is on the line, when there's eye gouging and fish hooking and, you know, kicks to the groin, they're not really trained to be able to handle that type of thing. So I think it's a false sense of security that some of these guys, I think, have. And I think it's important to realize that if you're doing some type of martial art, that, you know, just because you're great at that sport of martial art doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be great at street fighting or that you should be going around street fighting, right?
Yes, your point is so well said. The NFL guys are some of the toughest, best athletes in the world. And, you know, they're very capable fighters. A lot of these guys grew up in tough environments, and I have profound respect for their street smarts and just the toughest. So many of them do train in different styles, but there may be a few who could be overconfident, such as any sport. It could be a big wrestler. It could be a big hockey player, though they tend to fight a bit more. We have some ideas about how the NHL could either clean up or the fights would end very quickly. you go one way or another. You know, again, it's not just, you know, any athletes, it's everybody. I never know what somebody else knows, and I consider that person comparably trained. And therefore, what I know, he could know. And I'm also cognizant that a weapon could be deployed at any second as well. You could get into a street fight where you're a trained fighter and you're getting the better of somebody, but then he pulls out a tactical folder as you're trying to put a Muay Thai clinch on him, and he's eviscerating you.
Yeah.
Or as you grab him, he could be maneuvering to pull out a handgun from the waistband or the rear. And by the way, 92% of all felons, according to FLETC, the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center run by the federal government, suggests that they carry a handgun in the front waistband. So that's someplace you got to look. And as far as the street smart go, too, 85% of the population or more is right side dominant. I take are you a righty?
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So most people are, and therefore a weapon or a dominant side attack is likely to come from the right side. So you have to obviously watch both sides and both hands. But for law enforcement, you know, we focus on everything, but particularly that right hand, what that's doing, and you know, is it reaching for something? So the best advice one can give, I think, is that you never underestimate your opponent. And again, do everything you can not to get in a physical confrontation. You just don't know what's going to happen. And some of the NFL players, lastly, you know, they're so strong and athletic, is that somebody who starts in with them is probably either trained or not quite right in the head, but may bring a weapon to the confrontation at that moment, or come back after them, or come with multiple people. So that's something we work with them on, just for their own safety off the field.
Yeah, the weapon is always the wild card in the fight. And, you know, no matter how big or tough you are, if someone pulls out a gun or a knife, it's like, you know, all of a sudden they have all the power. They're the tough guy now, and you really don't have any chance. So, you know, like you said, I think in the very beginning, it's so important to avoid having any of these conflicts whenever possible. And what, I think you mentioned that you're going to go back to some of the actual tactics of de-escalation, right?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the most important things is, again, understanding who you're dealing with. I put a story in one of the books where I was on a train platform, and I'll make it very brief. For whatever reason, guy took issue with me. He had a teardrop tattoo on his face, which meant that he was all likelihood a gang member and a tough one at that. And he looked at me and he thought I gave him some kind of look that I shouldn't have, but I wasn't. And it was a hot day, and I said to him, is that your little baby girl? Because he was with his wife or girlfriend with a baby. And he changed his demeanor immediately and said, well yeah, that is. I said, she's absolutely beautiful. How old is she? About 12 months. And he said, yeah. So what could have been, you know, a confrontation from his saying, what are you looking at, to complimenting his daughter, it changed the dynamic entirely. So, wow. You know, it's things like that.
Yeah.
I think that people can – sorry, let me interrupt you.
No, go ahead.
But I think that another good explanation is that, let's say you're driving, and this happens probably to most people, and you're cut off, but that person gives you a conciliatory wave or thanks you. Or, you know, the second person, you let one person out and the second person tries to get in, but they still give you a wave. That's a way of creating a deconfliction. You know, they were in the wrong maybe, but they said they were sorry. Mm. And that analogy would probably hold through for the street, where I might, you know, inadvertently bump into somebody or do something that offends somebody. And if I can issue a sincere apology, meaningfully, you know, eye contact, the whole bit, maybe it would just diffuse the situation. It's really common courtesy. The problem, of course, is that there's some people who won't accept an apology, and they feel, you know, through social violence that their manhood or womanhood has been affronted, and they want to start in with you. And that's where you've got to, you know, assess the situation quickly. If you can walk away, you do it. And nothing is worth getting killed over, you know, but for saving your body and your family or something like that. No watch, no phone, nothing like that in a robbery situation. You comply the best you can. But if they want to take you someplace else, secondary crime scene, then you've got to react. So back to de-escalation. Again, you just want to use the best common sense you can. And understand also triggers, such as, you know, any staring at somebody beyond 2 or 3 seconds eye contact, some kind of emotional intent is usually going to be perceived. People's personal space. People are pretty guarded about their personal space. And if you inadvertently walk into somebody's personal space or get too close, you probably just want to put your hands up to show you don't mean anything, but in a nice way, not in a threatening way or pointing. You don't have a weapon in your hand. It's that kind of thing. So at the end of the day, a lot of it is common sense. And, you know, you've got to practice some phrases probably in your own mind to rehearse ahead of time, because in a fractured situation or someplace where there's confrontation, your adrenaline might start to build up and you might, you know, get a bit tongue-tied. So you want to think of, hey, you know, I'm really sorry, or I see, you know, you had a tough day. You know, I'm really sorry about what happened. Are we cool? Or another one, maybe, you know, if I were in your position, I totally see where you're coming from. I really didn't mean that. You know, I hope we're okay. Things like that, you know, but your own personal explanation about how you want this person to feel, and that you didn't mean anything harmful by what you did or said.
Yeah, no, that's a lot of great information, man. Going back real quick to the guy with the teardrop tattoo, which it's pretty classy, I should say. did he actually, when you were looking at him, or when you looked at him really quickly, did he say anything to you? Like said, oh, like, what are you looking at? Or was it just like you kind of sensed that he was going to say something, and then you just interjected before he could even do anything?
I sensed that he was going to say it, and then he said it. He said, hey, you got a problem?
Oh, okay.
And I said, no, that's, you know, that's fine. I held the door open for him, for his family, and he was very appreciative of that. So it's just amazing the way people's emotions can flip on a dime, and it can go the other way too. Somebody can be, you know, entirely polite, social, and nice, and a switch can flip like that, and then they attack you. So again, with anybody who approaches within 5 feet, he or she could be a threat. I do not like people approaching me quickly. I'm very, very cautious about it. You know, I would afford the same courtesy to everybody else. So, you know, again, anybody who is using a ruse to get up to, you know, what time is it? For example, if somebody asks me what time it is, I don't know them. I actually take 2 steps back, raise my watch up in front of my face to see that the sight picture is not only the watch, but the person. Or the same thing with the cell phone. I hold it up in front of me so that I'm not looking down to avoid getting a, blindsided, literally.
Yeah. No, yeah, I mean, that actually just remind me of that game they were doing a couple of years ago, that, you know, game, I don't even, air quotes, you know, stupid game that people were doing in, like, New York and a bunch of other major cities, like the knockout game, people just kind of running up.
Knockout game, yeah.
Yeah, knocking them out, like, how ridiculous and sick is that?
And then a few of these characters were shot legally in the states that allow for concealed carry, and you saw that wane a little bit. So there's a problem there, though. If somebody hits you just for the sake of doing it, and then they walk away laughing, and you were to then counterattack, or, for example, in other states to shoot, you're gonna answer for it. It's not justifiable unless it is an imminent threat, and it is either an impending threat, an imminent threat, or they continue to attack you. But you've got to be able to articulate, again, what you did and why you did it.
What do you do in that situation? If someone did do something like that, they just come up and sucker punched you and, like, basically knocked you out. You're saying, basically, by the law, you wouldn't be able to then shoot them, or, you know, at least kind of seek some type of revenge that's of equal force?
No, it's you have got to file, legal charges. You got to follow the legal process. The only time you can continue to, you can use your self-defense is if they, again, are hovering over you, or they're still close enough to present a threat. Interestingly, it's a little known fact, but you can actually defend your property. Most people will explain you can't shoot somebody for scratching your car or something like that. And you really can't shoot somebody. But if for example, I were in a an automobile sort of, I don't know, problem or confrontation, what would happen is if he got out, and I have a photo sequence that will come out one of his books, and he takes a flashlight or something, you know, and beats the front of my car with it, I'm actually allowed to intervene and stop him from physically damaging my property. But the key is that if he scratched the car with a key and then walked back, I can't counterattack. And here's the difference, is that he's continuing to damage the property, just as he's continuing to damage you. If you were attacking you, then you can obviously use self-defense and do whatever you've got to do to protect the situation. But if he disengages and then you go after him seeking vengeance or retribution, while he's in the wrong, you could also end up in the wrong.
In today's age, it can be hard to find the time to sit down and learn more. It's not easy when the likes of social media can be so addictive and time-consuming. So you may think you don't have the time to read a book or to develop yourself, but you do. There is an app I highly recommend, and it's called Blinkist. Blinkist is the only app that takes the best key takeaways, the need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books, and condenses them down into just 15 minutes so you can read or listen to them fast. Blinkist is made for busy people like you who want to get the main points of the books quickly without having to read the entire book. With an audio feature, Blinkist makes it so easy to finish 4 books a day while you are on the go. 8 million people are using Blinkist right now, and it has a massive and growing library. From self-help to business to health to history books, it's got it all. I like Blinkist because in less than 15 minutes, I feel like I can fast track my path to a more intelligent and informed me. I use Blinkist most mornings when I'm making my morning smoothie. In fact, this past week alone, I've gone through The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey, The Power of Habits by Charles Duhigg, and Start With Why by Simon Sinek. I love being able to breeze through some of these incredible books and still get the main takeaways from them. It's actually really, really cool. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/elite to start your free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/elite to start your 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/elite.
Man, there's just something innately wrong with that. You know what I mean? It's just, I get it. I get, like, you know, it's a type of, like, human emotion that they've tried to ban, and, you know, going and two wrongs don't make a right is essentially what it is, right? Like, but I get, you know, on the other hand, it's like, I understand someone who's, like, really damaged like that, or someone who gets knocked out or whatever, someone who just, like, goes in and completely messes up your car. Like, you want to hurt that person. It's a pretty fucked up thing to do, and for them to just get away with it, or, like, you know, they sucker punch you and then they run away. It's like, yeah, how are the cops ever going to catch them? They're just not. They got away with it. Yeah. You know, they messed you up.
Yeah.
I don't know. And, you know, it might be a little crazy for me to say, but I just think, you know, people like that kind of deserve to get that revenge on them that they sought upon themselves when they went after and committed that type of crime. So, but yeah, I mean, legally, yeah, you can't do anything, and you're right. You're 100% right. Following your advice is definitely the recommended thing to do here.
It is. And again, think of personal space, such as, you know, again, good common sense when you're driving is to follow, you know, maybe 5 lanes behind somebody just for, you know, the ability to evade and to, you know, brake to preempt an accident. And it's the same thing with people, you know, when you're in open spaces. The problem, of course, is that, you know, many of us live in urban areas, and there are many, many people, and you can't create that personal space that you would like. So, you know, the code of conduct changes a little bit. I've seen a lot of street justice administered in the subway. I'm not to say whether I was part of it or not, but, you know, there's a lot of pushing goes on, and there are subtleties that people do that I pick up on, there's retribution, but hopefully everybody's behaving.
Yeah. So, you know, not to get into specific, scenarios that you've gone through in the past, but just, is there anything you could share about, like, some type of thing that either, you know, you or somebody you know has done in like a self-defense thing where you've used this type of training?
Yeah, one of our instructors. I'm gonna use an instructor, not myself.
Okay, good. Yeah.
he was at a party, and, you know, a guy started him with his girlfriend, and it led to pushing. And Dave pretty much pounded the guy in the wall using successive punches and elbows. And then the guy started to reach for a knife. And because Dave was trained, he knew to secure the knife before it was deployed. And he was able to take the knife away without it being deployed and, you know, wrap the guy up. And the police arrived, and the guy had some priors, so he was taken away. So the thing is, we know that it works. We've got great feedback from some of our law enforcement community. One of my very good friends, Pudi Carson, who does the NFL training, is a police officer. He's used this many different times. He was able to stop a guy from pulling a weapon out on him using the tactics. I fortunately steer clear of most confrontations. I've had to use it a couple times, and mostly it's been in a preemptive capacity to show that I'm not going to be a victim. And ultimately, everybody has a red line, the proverbial red line, which you don't want somebody to cross. Some will let people cross it a little bit. Some won't even let you get near the boundary. So everybody's got a breaking point. It's just a question of when. And the responsible Krav Maga, people who train with us, again, avoid these kind of confrontations. But if it does come your way, you do everything humanly possible. But on the flip side, if that switch has to flip, forgive the pun, we're not going to let that attacker get the advantage. And they're not going to, you know, the way we look at it is, if somebody has an intent of throwing 4 or 5 punches at me, I'm not going to let them do one, let alone one or two. I'm not going to let somebody get in a groove and continue to attack me. I'm not going to trade blows. It's about overwhelming the attacker using sound tactics. And, you know, more about that is, it's just the ability to get off the line of the attack, traps to use preemptive self-defense. And when multiple attackers come along, you gotta move. You can't allow yourself to be put in the middle of them because they can take you to the ground. We do a lot of the ground survival tactics based on what we do standing. There's specific things such as defeating rear naked chokes and guillotines and defeating an arm bar. And again, that's in book number 8 against a skilled fighter. But ultimately, you got to be prepared for anything and everything. And that's sort of what Krav Maga is probably best known for.
Yeah. No, it's, you know, it's pretty cool what you guys are doing and the type of power or just ability to feel safe that, you know, when people go out, if, you know, especially like women or smaller guys. I'm actually a pretty smaller guy myself. I'm 5'7", about 160 pounds. So, you know, like this type of thing is great for smaller people, people who aren't those NFL giants or physically just like beasts, like monsters of men walking around. And, you know, they go out at night, they want to feel safe. And also they don't want to be disrespected, but the de-escalation techniques in case like someone is disrespecting them. I think that, you know, that stuff is great to make sure you're trying to just stop it before it becomes something more serious. Than it is. I'm curious though, if someone tried to like go up to you and start a fight with you, or say like rob you, say that guy in the on the train there with the teardrop whatever tattoo on his face, someone like that just comes up to you and, you know, he's not with his daughter and his wife and he has like a knife on him, what do you do if he just says like, give me all your money, give me your phone, give me your wallet? Do you just give it to him like that, or do you take a stand for something like that? Or say he doesn't have a knife and he's just telling you to like basically like trying to bully you, like, you know, what do you do in that case?
It's a question I think we all ask ourselves, especially those who train. As Grandmaster Gidon says, it depends on a number of factors, and it's good common sense. If I'm with my wife and my kids, my thinking changes because they're my priority. And while I may fancy myself, and I don't, by the way, as a, you know, a tough person or you know, proverbial badass, again, I don't. I may rue the day that I didn't do anything, but I've got to always emphasize to myself that it was better that I gave up whatever I had to give up then risk Claire or my boys getting shot if it were a handgun.
Yeah.
If it's myself, I might act differently. But the key with all of this is that I shouldn't have time to think about any of that. If my training is really good, I should be reacting. And that's the key with somebody coming up to you, you know, with a hand that is hidden. Or we train a lot for our handgun disarms on the immediate recognition of the handgun, not even thinking about what you're doing, but it's instantaneous. And that's really the key with superior training. If somebody is going to strong arm me, I probably not going to let them do it. And interestingly, some of the statistics, particularly the FBI has put out and the state of New Jersey, more than half of all muggings are actually strong arm. And the definition of that is that no weapon is involved. You may have multiple muggers threatening you, but oftentimes no weapon is employed because either they didn't have a weapon or they didn't want to risk being prosecuted for a weapon where the felony charges are much is aggravated. They're much more severe than not having a weapon. So it's a question we have to ask ourselves. I drum it in with students all the time. For me, if I'm going to react, it's going to be right away as soon as I see the weapon. If I have time to think about it, unless he's trying to take me to a secondary crime scene or move me, which you never want to do, I may use compliance. It just really depends on the situation, but I do think about it quite a bit. We need all think about it to prepare ourselves because the mental training can be almost as important as the physical training.
So if someone does come up to you and tries to strong arm you, what's like the first move that you do? What's the go-to move? I know this is like the, you know, most popular question. You probably get asked this the most. What's the one move, David? What's the secret move to take this person out? What is the thing that you do?
I prefer a precise sidekick to the knee, but that presumes that I'm in a position to do it. If I get caught in a passive stance, I'm not bladed. While I can still deliver a sidekick, it's probably going to be a straight kick. And I mention kicks because they're your longest range weapons. And hopefully I'm recognizing the threat before he gets within hand range. The rear is a different story. When we train to defend against rear attacks, we spend about three times as much. I emphasize spending about three times as long defending against rear attacks because that's where you don't see it. And it's really hard to preempt it. So that's where tactile feel comes in, such as a gun to the back, a knife, or a choke. And we actually train with real blades because I want people to feel the difference through a T-shirt. We're very careful with them versus a handgun, so you know what's back there. You can't necessarily see it, although you should try to turn your head. So, you know, it's that kind of thing that's got to be instantaneous. And when I mean instantaneous, it's like you get a mosquito on your neck and you slap it. Or, you know, something where, and if you ever try driving, and maybe it's inclement weather or you've got snow or mud, anytime anything is kicked at your windshield, you automatically blink. This is not something that we're going to overcome, So we need to work with that sort of flinch, blinking reaction, and execute the defense immediately. So in other words, it's wired into us to react, and we're just honing it.
How effective are things like kicks to the groin or gouges to the, like pokes in the eye, like moves like that that are kind of almost like cliche at this point? Like everybody just thinks that that's the takeout move. Are they actually effective for those types of things?
They are, but they can't be relied on alone. And there's all sorts of ridiculous Krav Maga t-shirts that are flooding the internet and Amazon, you know, such as, The Simpsons put one on, kicked him in the groin. Some people can take a kick to the groin. I don't say that they like it. I think there's a famous Beavis and Butthead, for those who are old enough to remember, where one of them gets kicked and says, "Thank you, sir, may I have another?"
Yeah.
So I joke about it, but there are some people who can withstand it. It's effective, but it can't be relied as just the only combative to seal the deal, so to speak. You know, some people even wear groin protection on the street. Muggers or somebody who might really be thinking ahead about what their vulnerabilities are. But just to circle back to one other point, great point you made. About 3 pounds of pressure to the eyeball is all that normal people can stand. So we can all generate that pretty easily with our thumb or our first or middle finger, and any of the fingers can generate it. And secondly, Grandmaster Gidon is one of the strongest men I'll ever know, and he's still beating me up at age 75, all of us for that matter. I don't know a tougher individual. I can't speak highly enough for him. Rick, same thing. You know, he's not as old as high him, but these guys are as tough as they come. But they're not big men. They're about 5'7". My very good friend Igal, we call him our Israeli pit bull. You definitely want him on your side. He's not so tall either, but they're all very strong. But even if they didn't have that kind of strength, the combatives are designed for smaller people to work against bigger people. And this is where Krav Maga has kind of gone off sometimes, where you have a larger instructor who can do certain things that a smaller person can't do, whether it's male or female, doesn't matter. But in other words, they're just so physically strong. And I try to, I'm not that big, but I'm pretty quick, and I have to always measure what I can do versus what the average person can do. And I'm not saying I'm a great athlete or anything, but you know, I've been training for a while. So you got to look at it as what will work for the average person, you know, that common man or woman. But even if they're disabled, we work with people in wheelchairs. One of the greatest things we've been able to do is work with some disabled veterans who are missing a limb. Krav Maga conforms to the person, and the person doesn't conform to it.
I know this whole approach is designed for people who, you know, like you said, aren't the biggest people, aren't the most athletic. Do you recommend at all people use things like, I'm thinking about women now, like they walk around sometimes with like pepper spray or mace. Do you recommend people carry those types of things, or even, you know, tactical pens or knives, or even, you know, LTC, license to carry, if they have a gun? Is that a good approach for a lot of people to have, or is that just kind of sometimes create more problems than it's worth?
True and true.
Okay.
The point you make is terrific, but with one caveat: they have to train extensively in whatever he or she is going to possibly use as a designated weapon or a weapon of opportunity. In other words, the training can't just be a one-time thing where you release the most and say, "I'm good to go," because again, everything around Krav Maga is based on concerted resistance. The attacker is not going to cooperate. The good Krav Maga teaches it this way, and they're going to do everything they can to injure, maybe kill you, but to win the situation. That's the element of an ambush. So if you're not prepared to use it in an ambush, if you still have that tactical folder in your pocket, it's great to have it there. But in a time of need, under pressure testing, and you're getting attacked, if you're not able to deploy that folder, and there are other issues with a folding knife anyway, you got to rethink it a little bit. So yes, carry anything and everything you can, including CCWs, concealed carry permits, but be very well trained in them. And one thing that we also specialize in for civilian training, this is a high-level type of course, is that we teach a lot of law enforcement military weapon retention, but civilians have that obligation as well, and they may not have the level 3-4 retention holsters that law enforcement do. So when you carry a weapon, a knife, a gun for that matter, you better be able to retain it. In other words, somebody taking it away from you. And you better be able to also retain it if you deploy it. Maybe you use it, maybe you don't. But if then the assailant says, "Boy, you know, I just, if you were carrying a knife and somebody threatened you and they look like a fighter and you brought the knife out," he or she can then argue, here's the danger, that now, although they initiated it, the flip side of this is that you're threatening to use deadly force against them, and they can then use deadly force against you. It's an argument, it's a fact-based argument, everything else too. So I myself don't carry a knife. I don't do it because, quite honestly, I might use it. Chances are I don't get in those kinds of situations, but there's always that half a percent of 100 that you might use it. And I can use it with great effect. So given my background and everything else, I hope I'm not inviting somebody to come up and challenge me because I don't have a knife, whether I'm telling you the truth or not. I am in this case. something like a cane is a great walking tool, a rattan cane. Mm-hmm. There's certain rattan canes out there. We've got a whole course designed around it, and it could be any kind of walking stick, an umbrella for that matter. Because carrying a cane or a stick, even, one of the great federal air marshal instructors, former gunnery sergeant, great friend of mine, carries a cane wherever he goes. He doesn't need it. But it is a great deterrent. People do not necessarily want to tangle with you when you're holding a big stick. Quote Roosevelt again, walk or speak quietly and carry a big stick. Just carry a big stick.
So the gun aspect, you don't actually carry a gun. Do you recommend that either or no?
Well, honestly, I, in law school, did carry a firearm. In New Jersey, it's very difficult to obtain a license. I have, a bunch of police officers and friends, and my status I'm not going to talk about. But the thing is, when you can carry a handgun, you better be prepared to use it. And there was twice in law school where I, one time I had to deploy the handgun and the guy backed off, but he never took his hand out of his jacket pocket. And I strongly suspected he intended to mug me. And that was an experience where as soon as the situation was done, I was very calm during it. And I put my Glock across my chest. I was in a Jeep. My window was open. It was a nice night and I could not move. The car was hemmed in and he noticed I had New Jersey plates and he sauntered over and said, "Hey, I'm from New Jersey, man. Can you spare some change?" And I said, "Oh, let's see." He said, "No, I could use some money." And he had his right hand for that matter, in his coat. And I put the Glock across my chest and said, get back now. Not shrill, just, deep, deep, calm voice. And the guy jumped back. But what struck me as I was zooming away, my adrenaline was hitting and I was, obviously upset about the situation that just happened, is they never took his hand out of his pocket. So, again, I thank the training for that. Just the other day, I actually had a problem on the highway where the road was very icy, and I inadvertently I lost control of the vehicle, as other people had. But the training helped me in that I was on the phone with my partner, and I said, "Hey, look, I'm going to get in an accident right now. I hope I do not 360 this." And rather than hitting the brakes, I turned into the skid and I regained control of the vehicle, all while he's asking me, what's going on? And again, it's not that I'm a good driver or a bad driver. It's just that I was able to allow the calmness from the training to work in that situation. And I'm not saying that I've got nerves to steel, because I don't. I have not been in combat. I have so many great friends who've made from the military and law enforcement, seen combat. I try to get better from their experiences. They're the heroes to me. But the point is that the training, if it's done properly, can really save the day. And that's my emphasis, I guess, in large part with the great podcast we're talking about.
Awesome, man. No, it's awesome. Is there anything else that you wanted to mention about the Krav Maga Combatives book coming out that you think our listeners should know? Or did we pretty much cover a lot of the bases? And, is there anything else that you wanted to share?
Sure. No, thanks so much. Yes. It'll be out in June. It's probably one of our best books. It's pretty extensive. Not only do we show combatives, we show some of the most common attacks. Again, reemphasizing, if somebody grabs you and tries to punch you, somebody tries to choke you from the rear, takedown defenses, grabs, but it's all integrated with combatives. So not only will you learn the core combatives and combinations we emphasize, compound kicks, that sort of thing, all very practical, but we're adding, some of the situations. And we're about to launch Mastering Krav Maga 2.0, courtesy of my great friend Justice Mitchell, Big Block Studios, who set up the podcast. And that's probably going to be the most, it'll be the most extensive Krav Maga video library in the world. I'm going to be doing some extra updates in a week. It's about 475 lessons. And you're going to get an invitation to it as soon as we get off the podcast to join up. So that's www.masteringkravmaga.com, one word. And we do a bunch of seminars, too. Anybody's interested in coming to our seminars or having us come to you, please do. We really specialize, in law enforcement training more and more with the use of force issues. Delighted to work with departments. Anybody who's interested, anybody who's responsible, they're most welcome to contact and train with us. So I really appreciate your time. This is quite an honor to be here and some great discussion.
Oh, thank you, David. I really appreciate it, man. And what's just a last send-off takeaway message for the Elite Man audience? And yeah, we'll leave it at that, man. Guys, definitely check out MasteringKravMaga.com, also his main website, DavidKahnKravMaga.com. David, what's the final takeaway message for the Elite Man audience?
I'll give one more plug to Amazon is actually the best place to get all these products that you were kind enough to mention. But for the Elite Man, when I first began Krav Maga, it's just my nature. I wanted to be elite to whatever I did. And I said, you know, I want to pick something that's going to get me to a very high level in a short time and make me not necessarily an elite fighter, but have the capabilities of an elite fighter to defeat any threat. And Krav Maga fit the bill. So a few tactics taught well and mastered by a good instructor will make you very, very capable. And when you have that kind of capability and you know what you can do in your own defense or defense of the family, you can avoid many situations that might involve, you know, antagonizing you, assaulting one's manhood. You know, maybe a drink is spilled on you. Maybe you get pushed because you know, and this is what Rick Blitzing taught me, you know that you are capable of doing great damage to that individual. And even if you walk away and he feels he's got the better of you, it's his lucky day. He doesn't know it, but it's his lucky day. And because you walked away, it's your lucky day. So how's that for sort of a corny way of summing it up?
No, but, I love that.
Things work well. A few things work well. And hey, if we have to do a second podcast or anybody's has additional questions to send in, let's do it. I really enjoyed the time with you. I appreciate it so much.
Awesome, David. Thanks so much. Yeah, I'd love to. Let's set something up in a few months, man. Get you back on the show. I'd love to pick your brain again. This, like I mentioned at the very beginning, this topic is just incredibly fascinating to me. Always in my entire life, have been fascinated by martial arts and self defense. So, you know, it was a true honor having you on the show, man. And take care, and I'll talk to you soon.
We'd love to do it. Thanks, everybody, listening.
Bye-bye. All right, guys. I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I need you to do. I need you to subscribe to this podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast interviews with all of our incredible world-class guests from the lifestyle, health, fitness, business, and social worlds absolutely free. Subscribe now, guys, if you haven't already, and enjoy all future episodes. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an awesome review. We really do appreciate it.